the book of Revelation. It's our new series today. I wanted to call it John's Apocalypse and then have like, you know, scary movie music play in the background, but I decided not to. Instead, I've gone with the book of Revelation from Patmos to Papamoa, John's Apocalypse is Monday to Friday good news. There you go. It just felt like it rolled off the tongue just a lot easier. And instead of having graphics from an Iron Maiden t-shirt, I've gone with a balding guy with a graying beard making notes on an incredibly large journal. Like, that's a very large journal for first century context, may not be accurate to original scroll written upon. Of course, this move is intentional because from the outset, I want to draw you to the attention as we kind of unfold and journey throughout the book of Revelation. I want to draw your attention to Revelation as good news, not as scary news. It's good news. The book of Revelation is good news. No scary music required. And also want to draw your attention to, as we go along, maybe not as much today as I'd like to in the weeks ahead, draw your attention to the book of Revelation as good news for your Monday to Friday. From Patmos to Papamoa. If you don't know, John had his vision and wrote his notes for the book of Revelation on the island of Patmos. So I want to draw your attention to the reality that this has something for us today that's helpful for us on a Wednesday or a Thursday as we're navigating life. It's not just a unusual bookend to the Bible that we kind of will push to the side and stick to the book of Proverbs, which is a lot more straightforward. So I want to kind of start with that in mind, hence, you know, no scary music and no Iron Maiden t-shirt covers, just to get you going. But I do want to start with a quiz first. So this is heavy metal lyrics versus Revelation. So don't yell out. Just whisper to your neighbor whether you think this is heavy metal lyrics or whether you think this is from the book of Revelation. Don't use Google or chat, please. All right. So is this heavy metal lyrics or the book of Revelation? On through the dead of night with the four horsemen ride, or choose your fate and die. Time has taken its toll on you. The lines crack your face. Famine, your body, it is torn through, withered in every place. Pestilence for what you have to endure and what you have put others through. So just whisper to your neighbor, is this heavy metal lyrics or is this the book of Revelation? You just let your neighbor know what you think there. All right, next one. We don't have time to examine it. Next one. The kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, and everyone else, slave and free, hidden caves, among the rocks of the mountains, calling to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us. Is that the book of Revelation, or is that, don't yell it out, just whisper to your neighbor, book of Revelation, or heavy metal lyrics. All right, the next one. The sky is turning red, return to power draws near, fall into me, the sky's crimson tears, abolish the rules made of stone. So again, is that the book of Revelation, or is that heavy metal lyrics? You can decide, just whisper to your neighbor. Some of you are like, surely this is all heavy metal. Others are like, surely this is all the book of Revelation. So, all right, and last one. I have become a brother of jackals, a companion of owls. My skin grows black and peels. My body burns with fever. My lyre is turned to mourning and my pipe to the sound of wailing. Is that which is which there? So again, just have a chat to the person next to you. All right, here it is on the screen. Our first one, that was lyrics from a Metallica song, so I hope you got that correct. That was Metallica's song, The Four Horsemen, from the wonderful album Kill 'Em All. So there you go, that was Metallica just to start the day. The next one up on the screen, that was Revelation chapter 6, verse 15 to 16. So I hope you got that right. We look forward to that in a few weeks' time. That'll be great. The next one, that was from Slayer, and I've got the tape there. Again, from their song Raining Blood, from the wonderful album Rain of Blood. So, you know, there you go. This heavy metal from the 90s. And then the last one, that was me being cheeky, that's from the book of Job. So that was neither Revelation nor heavy metal lyrics. So there was no way you could have. Did anyone pick the book of Job? Did anyone say, hang on, there's an anomaly there. We had the book. Well done. Well done, Mary. Like, well done. There you go. There's a $500 prize. Just see somebody down the back afterwards. They'll give that to you. All right. Bit of fun. Although, another interpretive clue for you as we dive into the book of Revelation. Any reading of Revelation that aligns with the perspectives of late 20th century heavy metal bands is likely a poor and unhelpful reading of Revelation. So that's just for free for you. So everything else you're paying for, but that one's free. If your reading of Revelation aligns with early 90s heavy metal bands, it's not a good reading of Revelation, and we need to go back and do a little bit more work. What I'm wanting to do here is recognize, before we even open the book of Revelation, is that there's a better than average chance that many of us have already been pre-discipled in particular direction in regards to Revelation before we even open the book of Revelation. We already come to it with ideas and thoughts and impressions and perspectives before we've kind of studied it in a theological sense. Popular culture has very likely already influenced our imagination in regards to what's going on in the book of Revelation. Our theology is long formed, is formed long before experts like Professor Richard Borkum or Dr. Michael Gorman have kind of impacted us. We've already probably picked up some stuff from Iron Maiden or Machine Head without realizing it. And it's important to pay attention to that. Already been formed by B-grade movies and C-grade books, or obsessed armchair theologians and end times paraphernalia, which is really what I'm going to mostly focus on this morning, armchair theologians and end times paraphernalia. But it's just important to acknowledge that we've already probably got ideas that have kind of been, it's the like fish that don't realize that they swim in water. We're probably swimming in some ideas that we don't realize didn't come from good study. They just came from culture around us. In a way, that's not true of most of the other books of the Bible. Most of the other books of the New Testament, particularly the book of James or, you know, Philemon or Philemon, however you want to say it. Like, we're not swimming, we've all got these preconceived ideas on the book of James based on The Simpsons. Like, we don't. Like, but when it comes to the book of Revelation, there is certain water that we are swimming. And we're going to unpack some of that this morning. So we may have inherited some popular beliefs in regards to Revelation that may not be as theologically astute as we suppose them to be. We're going to draw attention to that. Revelation 1 verse 3 says, "Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear it and take to heart what is written in it, because the time is near." Well, I'm going to unpack a little bit of my story with the book of Revelation. For years, I decided that this would just be a blessing that I would miss out on. I'd get some other blessings from other things. There's the Lord's handing out blessings in all sorts of different ways in all sorts of different books of the Bible. But this one here, well, someone else can have those blessings. I'll skip that. Grew up in a classical Pentecostal church context, and like many kids of the 1980s, we watched movies at church on a Sunday night, which we were always super pumped about. Come along to church, there's no sermon, we're going to watch a movie, or you can eat popcorn. You know, it doesn't get better than that for a kid on a Sunday night going to church. The next minute, you've spilt your popcorn, you're having the fright of your life, the kettle is boiling, but there's no one to turn it off, there's empty shoes left on the kitchen floor, and somebody's been left behind. Somebody's been taken away, and, you know, it's very disorientating. It's very disorientating. And, of course, I'm referring to these movies. The Thief in the Night is a great title. A Distant Thunder, Image of the Beast, and The Prodigal Planet. A quartet of Christian horror movies intended to keep the youth on the straight and narrow. That's how I describe them. A quartet of Christian horror movies intended to keep the youth on the straight and narrow. Of course, there are some of you who have no idea about these movies and some of you who remember them. I do know when I was talking to a friend who had no ideas about one of these movies, I said, go and watch it on YouTube. So he watched the first one on YouTube. He goes, no way am I doing those other three. But feel free to, you know, dip back into them. Everyone's afraid to watch Jaws. Jaws is one of my favorite movies. And people are like, no, that trauma. Go back and watch Jaws. It's actually like, it's a fun watch. There's nothing scary in Jaws. These ones, go back to these ones. They're equally as traumatized. It's like living that all over again. So if you're brave enough, you can go and do them. Check out the taglines. There will be no place to hide. Oh, that's great for a seven-year-old. The story of the tribulation and end times continues. Oh, there's some ideas. Now mankind has been given what we always wanted, a world without God. That's number three. Oh, that'll be good. And then the fourth one, a true story that is yet to happen. And do you remember that lovely little song? You may or may not, depends on the word you got. You know, there's no time to change your mind. The sun's come back and you've been left behind. I've always wanted to finish off that line like this. So, you know, you have nightmares for weeks. You burst into cold sweat and tears if you come home and find a pile of clothes and abandoned shoes. Or the lawnmower's running, but there's no one mowing the lawns. It doesn't matter that dad's around the corner emptying the catcher. You just see an unmanned lawnmower. You're like, oh, somebody's been kind of zapped away. Quite simply, there was a lot of fear involved, and it put a lot of people off. And again, I promise you, if you're reading Scripture and it's landing you in a place of fear, you're not a place of fear, worry, or anxiety, you're not reading Scripture correctly. Now, God's Word is not an invitation to fear, worry, and anxiety. And so if that's where it's landing you, something's gone wrong in the mix there. As I got older, the next thing that put me off was the obsession that people had with timelines and predictions of the future. One of the things, you know, you've got to respect the different genres of the Bible and pay attention. And some things are literal, some things are figurative, some things are metaphorical. One of the things is when Jesus says things, you can pretty much take them literally. Like when he says, about the day and the hour, no one knows. Not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Now, if you understand the Greek, what it's saying in the Greek is, no one knows, not the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. That's in Matthew 24, verse 36. It doesn't matter how many kind of layers you go down beneath, what Jesus was saying was what Jesus meant. No one knows the hour except for the Father. But then, of course, then comes out a bunch of books, and we discover that Jesus was mistaken. And that while Jesus didn't know the date or the hour, Edgar Wisnott, Hal Lindsey and co. had been let in on the secret. So unfortunate for Jesus, but there were some 20th century authors that had been let in on the time and the hour. And these old mates had some books and were ready to go with a tape series or two. So Edgar, he published a book about why the rapture, whatever that is, would be between September the 11th and September the 13th, 1988. And it was called 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Be in 1988. And it sold 4.5 million copies. 4.5 million copies. That's 4,499,500 more copies than my book on Advent has sold. And my book is better, objectively better, than 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Be in 88. And I'm still working, and he's retired. It's the injustices of the world that we can't get our head around. Well, 1988 came and went, but there were some follow-up books. They didn't sell as well. The Final Shout, Rapture Report, 1989, that was the next one. The one that came next was 23 Reasons Why the pre-tribulation rapture looks like it will occur in 1993. And now the Earth's destruction by fire, nuclear bomb fire, predictions for 1994. The sales did drop as time went off there. Essentially, doom and foreboding combined with predictions and timelines made me skeptical about the whole thing. It's like, oh, look, there's so much fear, don't want to read it. And then all these timelines, when Jesus has already said, nobody knows, but old mate knows, I don't even want to open the book of Revelation. I'm not keen. We'll just park that and we'll get to it. People would debate their views on the millennium, on the tribulation, on who or what the Antichrist is, on what the rapture is. And then people would ask my opinion, and I'd say, oh, I don't have an opinion. And they'd go, no, what do you think? What's your opinion? I don't have an opinion. Like, I've got nothing to share with you. I have no thought. Because you actually don't have to have an opinion. To have an opinion on everything is a very 21st century idea. You don't have to have an opinion on everything. You can have no opinion on some things and just carry on with your life totally fine. And that was me. Though, of course, as a pastor and a minister and a theologian who deals with the Bible, you do also acknowledge that at some stage there are certain social issues I never need to get to, but I probably need to get to the book of Revelation at some stage of another. But I didn't have an opinion. But many people, of course, would have their opinion. And in fact, when it comes to studying Revelation, bringing a predetermined opinion to the text is one of the... it's not an ideal place to start from, bringing a predetermined idea to the text. Instead of doing exegesis, which is to read meaning out of the text, we're doing eisegesis, which is to read meaning into the text, which is not the correct way to do theology. We have ideas that we expect to discover, and lo and behold, in a book as complicated and bizarre as Revelation, if you've got ideas you're expecting to discover, you'll find them there. Even if it's different to the ideas of the person reading it next to you, they'll find their ideas there, because it's full of fantastical imagery and all sorts of things which we'll get to at time. You can't read so many ideas into the book of Proverbs, for example, but Revelation, whatever your idea is, you can find something in there that'll back that up, but that's not a good way to handle the text. So some people take a preterist view of Revelation. Most of Revelation has been fulfilled, but some things are still to unfold. Preterist is just the Latin prefix for something that is in the past or beyond. So there's this idea that, most of Revelation, that happened back then. Others are futurists when it comes to Revelation. Most of Revelation has not been fulfilled, and prophecy awaits fulfillment. We're going to come back to that one this morning particularly. Others are historicists. Revelation is a commentary on the whole of church history. And the seven churches in the book of Revelation represent seven different times in church history. This was an idea that popped up around the time of the Reformation. Then some people hold what's called an idealist or a spiritualist view that divorces Revelation from any historical reference point. Instead, the text speaks about notions of good and evil, and is then generally relevant to all moments of history, but not particularly relevant to any moment, though generally relevant to all moments, and tackle the text like that. Well, pick any one of those four and start reading the book of Revelation. You'll find it. So the idea is not to pick one at the start, but rather to treat the text on its merits and then work out where the text takes us as we journey along. I won't comment on the merits or faults of the above, except say if you're looking to find it, you can find it. But Revelation has to be navigated like every other book of the Bible. What's the genre? Who was it written to? What issues is it addressing? How would the original recipients have understood it? And in light of that, what's the significance of Revelation for us today? Which we're going to kick off properly next Sunday. What I want to do this morning is highlight the futurist position on Revelation that has particularly influenced North America and then as a result, by default, us in New Zealand. This view holds that Revelation is about the future, it's about end times, it's about how there will be severe famines and wars and earthquakes and an antichrist will take over the world with a one world government and one economy and a false religion that everyone will be forced to embrace. And the antichrist will deceive most of humanity into following him, chop off the heads of those who don't get the mark. That's the movies back in the day, which is the mark of the beast that everyone has to get. God will then pour out his wrath and burn up a third of the world, hallelujah, inflicting pain upon humanity over a 7-year period. The church will go through a massive falling away before the tribulation, abandoning the truth, but a faithful remnant will remain. They'll get raptured away, maybe during the tough times, maybe before the tough times, maybe after the tough times, but that's essentially what the book is about. And likely, that's the kind of ideas that if you haven't thought through Revelation carefully, that's probably like the ideas you bring to the text. The thing is, though, there's no mention of any sort of rapture in the book of Revelation. It makes that one tricky. There's no antichrist mentioned anywhere in the book of Revelation, so that makes that one harder as well. And nobody thought that this was what Revelation was about for the first approximately 1,800 years of Christianity. So that makes that tricky as well. It's like, well, hang on, if nobody's thought that for 1,800 years, how is it that in the last 200 years that's the water that we've been swimming in so much? Essentially, these are all new fandangled ideas, and fandangled is a technical word. It is, if you look it up. These are new fandangled ideas. So how did we get there? How did we land with this futurist view coming to dominate the popular imagination so much? Well, once upon a time, there was a man named Ed Irving. He was a minister within the Church of Scotland, and by all accounts was a fantastic preacher and communicator. One of his hobby horses was a critique of the established church. That's been the hobby horse of many person for all of history. But that was one of his hobby horses, and he felt like the church had lost its spiritual vitality. Again, that's not a new idea. But he believed the end was nigh for the church, and eventually only a remnant would remain, living in eager hope for Christ's return and divine rescue. And like I said, he was a good communicator, he was a great preacher. His ideas were picked up by another preacher, a guy called John Nelson Darby, who developed them further. He was a minister in the Church of Ireland, but left to develop his own theology of end time events and a futurist perspective on Revelation. That's always a little giveaway as well. Like, you know, he was a part of this church, but left to start his own ideas on some things as a little giveaway. But his followers came together and formed what today is known as the Plymouth Brethren Church, which we exist in Tauranga, and you may have heard of before, the Plymouth Brethren Church. His key teachings included a secret rapture of the church prior to the return of Christ, a period of tribulation that would be followed by the return of Christ, and he believed that history could be divided into dispensations of time where God acted in the world in different times and different seasons in different ways. Eventually, his teachings crossed over the Atlantic in the 1870s to the good old US of A. And there was a guy, Cyrus Schofield, an American theologian and minister and writer, and he was particularly drawn to these teachings, to these ideas. They captured his imagination, and he brought into those ideas, and he thought, yep, that's truth, that's accurate, that's good stuff. And he was all on board with that. What Schofield ended up doing was he produced what's known as the Schofield Reference Bible, essentially a King James version of the Bible with study notes, essentially the first ever study Bible. You know, most Bibles were just English translations of the text. He produced essentially what we would know as the first study Bible, English translation of the text, and then commentaries and ideas and thoughts and explanations and, you know, inserted, you know, tables and blocks and, you know, extra information for experts to read along the way. And he put that together. It was a big time seller, and it genuinely helped people to make a lot better sense of the Bible. Except that when it came to Revelation, his footnotes endorsed everything as future events to take place and as end times worldview, the futurist view of Irving and Darby, despite the fact that this had not been the perspective of theologians and scholars for 1,800 years. He brought into that wholeheartedly. That was all of his footnotes on the book of Revelation. So you've got this wonderful study Bible with wonderful notes helping people all the way along the way from Genesis through to what comes before Revelation? Jude. John, Jude, Revelation. A great resource, a great study Bible, a great help and service to people. Except when it got to the book of Revelation, very particular ideas in regards to Revelation, very different to what was held by contemporary theologians and the church for 1,800 years. But no reference to that, just kind of something very good came to a less than ideal good conclusion, but no comment of that. So kind of people just take it for what it is and go, hey, that's really helpful, fantastic. Prior to this, the church fathers, the church reformers, church historians referenced nearly every aspect of Revelation as something that had already happened, something that had already occurred. And so there's 1,800 years of theological reflection ignored. Bible colleges and the like were established with this particular focus to advance these theological perspectives, a futuristic dispensationalist view of end times. It's 1909. People are reading the Schofield Reference Bible. They're thinking about Revelation in terms of end times, the beast, wars and famines, etc. You know, it's published in 1909. It's selling in 1910, 1911, 12, 13, 14, you know, beginning to take on, you know, momentum, etc., etc. Then you have World War I. And then you have the Great Depression. And then you have World War II. And so people are convinced they're living in the end times because the world is collapsing around them. And so it feels very much aligned to these end times ideas of the Schofield Reference Bible. People were convinced they were living in the last days. Revelation 13:13, and it performed a great sign, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of the people. And people thought that was Hitler, who introduced mass bombings. So Hitler must be the beast. And many people thought that World War II was the Great Tribulation. And you can understand why that would be the case. That's totally plausible and understandable. But then the war ends, and in one sense we have peace on earth. And you would think this would be a good idea to, you know, a good time to reframe and rethink our ideas about end times events, etc., etc., as war comes to an end. However, in 1948, events in the Middle East begin to heat up, And with the establishment of a homeland for Jewish people is realized with Israel being formed in 1948. Now, Matthew 24, verse 32 to 34, it says, "Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is near, right at the door. Truly, I tell you, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened." You don't have to understand Matthew 24, except that one interpretation of Matthew chapter 24 was that the fig tree blossoming represented the reforming of Israel. And then a generation will not pass away before the fulfillment of the other things, the returning of the Son of Man. I'm not advocating that as a good interpretation, but that interpretation existed. And so you do the math from 1948, and a generation is understood to be 40 years, the 40 years that the Israelites spent in the wilderness. Well, 40 years from 1948 is 1988, and which we've already mentioned. Just as there is a possibility of getting back on track with Revelation, things pivot even further. The reforming of Israel was catalytic, the oil crisis of 1956, the Cuban Missile Crisis, Middle Eastern conflicts, the Six-Day War, and then, of course, the Cold War as well. This is the water that particularly North American theologians are swimming in. And it's all go for sensationalist futurists, and publications go into overdrive in regard to the end times and the beast and the mark of the beast, etc., etc., etc. The truth is, popular media, books, songs, movies, all carry ideas way further than what a good sermon can take it. Even really good sermons with fantastic theology and funny stories and key points starting all with the same letter. Still, popular media takes the idea further than what a sermon can ever take the idea. So in 1970, we have the publication of Hal Lindsey and Carol Colson's The Late Great Planet Earth, which talks about the 1970s as the era of the Antichrist as foretold by Moses and Jesus, and the 1980s as the last decade of history as we know it. As it turned out, the 80s were the last decade of history as we know it, but that was more to do with the invention of technology and computers, and us 80 kids remember the 80s has been awesome. So you have this happening. Well, this book, it sold a lot more than my Advent book as well. It went on to become the best-selling non-fiction book of the 1970s. The best-selling non-fiction book of the 1970s. 28 to 35 million copies sold. That's a lot of copies, and a lot further than my book or my sermons go. I'm not bitter about this, but it was accepted almost without question, because supposedly it made it possible finally for the average person to understand the book of Revelation. And it took off like wildfire. 88 Reasons Why Jesus Will Return in 1988 sold 4.5 million copies, as I said. As the time drew closer to the dates predicted for September, Christian radio stations in the States started broadcasting instructions for Christians in regards to how to prepare for the rapture. And you can laugh, but at the same time, it's good to appreciate what people were living in. Parents in the 60s were wondering if they'd done the right thing in having children and bringing them into the world when it felt like you were living on the verge of a nuclear war. This is what this, you know, and again, we feel that in New Zealand, but in America in particular, it feels like you're on the verge of a nuclear war with the Cold War and all of these kinds of things happening. Parents who lived through World War II as children and young people, well, you put a book in their hands about end times and the ideas of getting zapped away to safety, and it actually sounds like a really good idea. The worse things are getting, the better the idea of being zapped away to safety sounds. The better things are getting, I don't zap me away. This is getting. But it feels like things are falling apart. So you can see why. This is picked up. Why there's an energy behind it. Why there's this interest in this stuff. But of course, 1988 comes and goes, and we're in 2026 now, which is quite a long way off from 1988. But 1988 comes and goes, and we get into the 1990s. And what's the one thing we've learned? Not that our predictions for reading the book of Revelation are totally wrong, but rather, scary end time books sell really, really well. So in the mid-1990s, with the year 2000 looming and Y2K, etc. on the horizon, Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins, they blessed the modern church. with their Left Behind series, which you will not find out on the bookshelf outside. But if you do want to donate them, we collect them and we take them out of circulation. So they blessed the world with their Left Behind series. 16 novels. 65 million copies sold. 65 million copies sold. Now, when you think about my book, no, you don't have to. All of this based entirely on a pessimistic, futurist theory of the end times. There's 3 full-length movies. There's 4 video games available on all of this stuff. So one particular preacher has an idea. Another preacher jumps on this idea. A third preacher puts it into a study Bible. And then a bunch of authors sell over 100 million copies in books and movies, promoting ideas and making millions of dollars. And ultimately, whoever tells the best story wins. And these movies tell the best story. And there are many, many great scholars in America. But if you hear N.T. Wright talk about all this stuff, he goes, "Oh, this wasn't really something we were going through in the U.K. That's a very American thing. It's like it didn't even kind of touch the U.K. like it touched America." But for us in New Zealand, we pay particular attention for whatever reason. I don't know what the reason is, but we pay particular attention to what is unfolding in America all the time. We still do in American politics, American theology. The church is incredibly influenced by that neck of the woods in contrast to the UK particularly. And so the water that the US is swimming in, that is kind of what filters down and becomes the water that we're swimming in here in New Zealand. And so for many Christians way down here in New Zealand, it becomes the preconditioned context and understanding of Revelation before we've even opened the book and begun to explore it. The preconditioned idea is it's all going to turn to custard, war and famine and tribulation, but we'll get zapped out of here and there'll be wrath and fire and, you know, all of these kinds of things, and there'll be a mark of the beast, and if you don't get that, you get your head chopped off on a guillotine from the movies in the 70s or the early 80s. And this just becomes the water that we swim in before we've even begun to explore the book. The rapture, Left Behind, the beast, the Antichrist, the whole of Revelation Unstood is almost exclusively futuristic in its content and promoting ideas basically non-existent for most of church history. And it's still happening today. I didn't realize, but a few months ago, I did a sermon on something. I can't remember what it was, but somebody said, "Oh, that was a good sermon. Was that because you had heard about the guy in Africa that was talking about the date that we're..." It's like, "Oh, no, I didn't even know that it happened." But it's like there's still people predicting dates. Again, Jesus said, nobody literally knows the hour. And then we sell over 100 million copies of books predicting the hour, and all of them were wrong, and then people still doing that. Maybe not so much in New Zealand, but I bump into pastors, or you bump into Christians, and there'll be something on the news headlines to do with Trumpistan, or to do with the Middle East, or to do with the Straits of Hormuz, or something like that. And they won't say that it's end times, but there's kind of this kind of wink, wink, nod, we know what this means. And I'm like, do we? What does this mean? It's like, you know, wink, wink, nod, nod, just, you know, get ready. People get ready. You don't want to be left behind. And it's more subtle, but it's this kind of, it's geopolitics framing our theology and our eschatology and our sense of what God's doing in the world and what's about to happen. And I bump into more pastors than what you do in the role I have and the work I do, but you come up against this, or you bump into this, and I just choose to, like, you know, beep, beep, you know, back the truck out and exit that conversation. But it still kind of bubbles away, despite there's some really good scholarship around the book of Revelation that we're going to explore that has existed for a long, long time. We still swim in those waters. One theologian put it like this. He said, "I think that Tim LaHaye, even though he might be a really nice guy, is pretty much 100% wrong when he suggests that the book of Revelation is only going to make sense the closer we get to the time when the events it describes are supposedly going to take place." He says, "I think he might be a really nice guy, but I think he gets 100% wrong when he says it'll all make sense the further we move forward in history." He said, "I think he's got it precisely around the wrong way. He couldn't be more wrong if he tried. I think the truth is closer to the idea that Revelation is going to make less and less sense the further we get away from the time and place when Revelation was written and who it was written to and how they would have understood the text and what was happening. Because of the widening gap between our own socio-historical situation and that of when Revelation first appeared. He's making the comment that if we really want to understand what Revelation is about, we don't move forward in time, we go back in time to what was happening in John's time. When he's on this island of Patmos, what's happening in these seven churches in these different areas of Asia Minor? What was happening in the world? What were they navigating? How would they have understood the book of Revelation? And then in light of that, how might we understand it? Craig Keener, in his commentary on Revelation, writes that many interpreters have simply failed to learn the original setting of the book and have in effect added to it, despite the warning in 22 verse 18, if anyone adds anything to them, God will add that person to the plagues described in the scroll, by reading into it theological systems not justified by the text itself. Craig Keener, world-renowned theologian, like highly respected, great commentary on the book of Revelation and Acts and a thousand other, you know, just writes book after book. He's a well-known. Precisely doing what Revelation warns us not to do. Don't add to it. Don't read theological schemas into the book of Revelation. Read out of it. Now, of course, way more needs to be said than what I've just said today. I've kind of deconstructed something without reconstructing something, but that's what we're going to begin to do next week. What I want to focus on is that we're taking things from the book of Revelation that are helpful for our Monday to Friday lives, from Patmos to Patmos. So our last slide this morning, takeaway for this morning. Monday to Friday, even though we haven't even opened the book of Revelation. Six times in Matthew 5, Jesus says, "You've heard it said, but I say unto you." You've heard it said, but I say unto you. I don't want us to underestimate for people how disorientating or deflating or destabilizing it might be to have Jesus say, "You've heard it said, but actually I say unto you this, this, and this." What they had heard were ideas that had shaped their lives, their worldview, their faith, their understanding of God. Then Jesus offers new ideas, better ideas, demanding ideas, but nevertheless new ideas, turn the other cheek. Lay down your life. Don't make oaths. Don't hate anyone. If you've got two cloaks, give one of those cloaks away. These are new ideas. These are kind of like, that's very destabilizing. It would have been a head scratcher for many. Nevertheless, it was an invitation to discover that the good news of the gospel is better than they just realized. It's an invitation to discover the good news of the gospel is better than they've just realized. An invitation to experience transformation and new life and new possibilities in Christ. I'm so glad in my life and in my journey, Jesus has stepped in different ways and whispered to me, "Joseph, you know how you think this, or you heard that this was said, or your understanding was this. That's great, but actually, I want to say this to you." I'm so glad that at different times Jesus has interrupted the status quo of my thinking and my worldview and my perspective and said, yeah, you thought that, but actually, and then invited me in different ways to see things in new light and see things from different perspectives and to kind of discover things that I hadn't kind of discovered before. Because every single time that the Spirit's whispered, even if at times it's been hard or demanding or disorientating, it's always opened the door to fullness of life. It's always opened the door to new and bigger and better horizons, not shrunken, smaller, less horizons. More than that, it reminds me, not everything I've heard or understand or think is accurate, true, or aligned to God's word. And I take that to be a positive thing. This is kind of a subversive piece of wisdom. Because, you know, one of our values as Christians, one of the things we celebrate as Christians is, "I've found Jesus, I've found the way, the truth, the life, I've found the truth." And so we celebrate that we've found the truth. "Yay, I've found the truth." But there's also moments along the journey where we go, "Yay, I didn't know the whole truth. There was more for it to discover that I hadn't discovered yet. Phew." It's a good thing to discover that the totality of your thinking is maybe they're not the totality of all there was. And now we know this to be true because I think it's James says we look now through a mirror dimly, through a glass dimly. We see in part, but we don't see the full. Because the truth is, if I have it all figured out and have got my head around everything, well, actually, it turns out to be a lot smaller than what it really is. But if I'm on a journey where I'm willing to be open to learning and discovering and hearing and allowing the voice of the Spirit to whisper truth, I discover, it's bigger than I thought it was. It's more beautiful than I thought it was. It's more life-giving than I thought it was. And I hope it's true for all of you that the longer that you go on in your faith, the more beautiful you discover it to be. Rather, I thought it was pretty good in my teenage years, but now that I'm 60, I realize it's pretty shrunken and shriveled and miserable, and we've got less to be hopeful than what I thought. It's like, no, that can't, no, it's the other way around. The good news of the gospel is always better than you've just realized. The problem is we don't know what we don't know. We have to go on that journey to discover that. N.T. Wright acknowledges that not everything he thinks is correct is correct. He just doesn't know which bits aren't the bits, because that's the journey to go on. If, on the other hand, there's more to discover just around the corner, new insight, new learning, perspectives that bring invitations and challenges and comfort and encouragement, well, the journey of discipleship is a new adventure every day. The journey of a long obedience in the same direction continues, of understanding, of growing to be the holy, whole, and wholesome people we're called to be, of knowing God, understanding God's word, of living the adventure of the gift and task of life that God's given us. The journey carries on to become who God has created us to be. So there's good news in discovering that what you've heard said is actually maybe not quite 100% right, but let me say unto you. And I'm not assuming that I have a perfect understanding of the text. I'm working overtime in the background to learn and to discover and to check with the scholars and these kinds of things. And I'm not assuming that you have a misunderstanding of the text. The work that you've done on your life may have created a beautiful understanding. What I am suggesting this morning is that the water that we all swim in points us in a certain direction before we've even opened the text, and not necessarily the right direction. And we'll have to unpack that further on. So if you find that a little bit disorientating, just relax in the disorientation, and we'll do next Sunday, and then we'll do the Sunday after, and then we'll do the Sunday after, and then we'll do the Sunday after, and then Sean DeToit will turn up and he'll talk, and then we'll do Q&A with Sean DeToit afterwards, and he can answer all your questions. And we'll journey through this, and it's impossible in one Sunday to rearrange everything. So all you can do is you're going to open that can. It's like, yep, we just opened that can. And now we'll continue the journey. So if that feels disorientating, just relax into that, and we'll pick up the journey next Sunday. Or if it feels exciting, and I hope that it does feel exciting as well for some, it's like, yeah, we'll look forward to next Sunday as we explore further. The book of Revelation. For now, though, our takeaway. I'm glad that not everything I think to be true is true, because that's an invitation to discover the good news of the gospel is better than I just realized, to grow and to be more and to become more and to understand more. Because if every answer I have right now is the correct answer, then we're making ourselves to be the infallible word of God that sees all truth and knows all truth and isn't called to go on a journey to discover more. That's a subversive kind of back to front truth. Because normally we just say, we've found the truth, celebration. It's like, yeah, we've found some of the truth, celebration. And let's all go on a journey together to discover more truth. All right, your homework this week. I would love you, if you could, between now and next week, to watch the Lego movie. The 2014 Lego movie. I promise you, if you can find the space to watch the 2014 Lego movie, you will be well set up for next Sunday, when we begin to tackle what's the genre of Revelation, who was it written to, what were they trying, it's all in there. It's all in the Lego movie of 2014. Not the Lego movie 2, the first Lego movie, 2000.